Welcome back to the Rav Hirsch on Parsha series for this week, Parshas Vayera. And this week I'm going to focus on a few pieces in Rav Hirsch's Parish on Chumash and this week's Parsha, which give us an insight into Rav Hirsch's philosophy of the Jew's place in the world around him and how we interact with the nations. So we begin at the very beginning of the Parsha, which follows the story of the Bris Milah, which ended Parshas Lech Lecha. And in Perek Yud Ches, the Parsha begins, Vayero Elov Hashem Be'elonei Mamre, V'hu Yoshev Pesach Ha'ohel Kechom Hayom. And Hashem appeared to him, to Avraham, at Elonei Mamre. And he was sitting at the entrance of the tent in the heat of the day. Vayisoyno Vayar, he lifted his eyes and he saw, V'yinei Shlosha Noshim Nitzavim Alav. And he saw that there were three men standing over him. Vayar, Vayorots, Vaylikrosam, he saw and he ran to greet them in Pesach Oel from where he was at the entrance to his tent, Vayishtahu Orza, and he bowed to the ground to those men. So here, Hashem appears to Avraham at the beginning of the Parsha, and Hashem's conversation with Avraham continues later on, where Hashem tells Avraham about the impending destruction of Sodom, and then Avraham davens to Hashem to spare the city. So Rav Hirsch first addresses the point of Hashem's appearance to Avraham, and why does Hashem need to tell Avraham about the destruction of Sodom? And it's interesting because specifically here, in the first story of the Parsha, where we read about Avraham's hachnasas orchim, and how he takes care of these guests who come to him, and he treats them so well. And particularly here, we see a contrast between Avraham Avinu and the behavior of the people of Sodom, whom we know were infamous for their mistreatment of their guests and for not helping out anyone. As we see later on in the parasha, in the next parak, how they react to the news that Lot has invited guests to his house. So we see this contrast between Avraham Avinu and Sodom. Avraham Avinu is the embodiment of kindness, and he's sitting here in front of his tent at the heat of the day. He's fresh off of Bris Milah. He's in pain. It's extremely hot outside. Rashi tells us that Hashem took the sun and he made it extremely hot so that Avram shouldn't have to have guests. But what did Avram do? He goes outside to the front of his tent and he's looking for guests, looking for people to help, trying to be hospitable to people who may need it. As opposed to Sodom, who's exactly opposite, looking to hurt people who may pass through their town. So why does Avraham need a warning about Sodom? We assume Hashem is telling Avraham about the destruction of Sodom as if to show him this is what happens to evildoers. But why does Avraham need that reminder if we see in this story especially how Avraham doesn't need that? He knows that. That those who do good, those who are helpful to people, those who are gomle chasadim, that they will be rewarded, and those who are not gomle chasadim will be punished. So Rav Hirsch explains that the message here was not for Avraham himself. The message was for his children, and in fact, it's specifically for that reason that the one story we have in the Torah of Avraham's hachnasas orchim in great detail is right here before the destruction of Sodom. Because for us, Avraham Avinu's children, Hashem wants us to have in our minds this picture. We have Avraham sitting in front of his tent looking for guests right next to the destruction of Sodom. These two stories in our mind go hand in hand. In fact, if you look in the Sefer Torah, there is no parsha break between the two prakim. These stories run on together, and that may be because the Torah wants to really emphasize the contrast and show us how this is the way of Avraham Avinu, this is the way of Sodom, this is what happens to Avraham Avinu, this is what happens to the people of Sodom. It's important to know that, especially because, as Rav Hirsch writes, Avraham's children are going to inherit this land, this Eretz Canaan, and they would do well, they would prosper, and they would grow. And in their prosperity, there is concern that they might lose sight of the legacy of Avraham Avinu, the legacy of Gemilas Chesed, and the legacy of Achnasas Orchim. And they might go down the path of Sodom and Amora, the cities which prospered in Eretz Canaan, and let that prosperity go to their head, and they wanted to keep it all for themselves and had no interest in sharing that with anyone else. And then we see what happened to them, and we see their downfall. In fact, this concern was not for naught, as we see in Sefer Yeshaya in the opening parak, which we read on Shabbos Chazon as the Haftorah, where the Jewish people are referred to as Kitzinei Sodom, Am Amora, because they have followed in the path of Sodom and Amora at that time. And they hurt the poor and the downtrodden, and they take no interest in them, and they do not want to help them. That's the very problem that Hashem is concerned with at this time. And Hashem is coming to Avraham Avinu to say, Sodom is being destroyed, so that it's a reminder to his children not to follow down the path of Sodom. And this story of Avraham Tachnas's Orchim is right here to contrast with the story of Sodom that follows, so that we always have them together. Rav Hirsch writes that they're juxtaposed in our chapter in one picture, a picture that shall be engraved forever in the minds of his descendants. We always put these two stories together in the beginning of our parsha. So that's one point Rav Hirsch makes about how this story fits in with what comes next. But there's also, Rav Hirsch points out, that there's a connection between this story of Avraham Avinu's Hachnasas Orchim and the previous section about Bris Milah. Because Avraham Avinu was, one of the reasons Chazal tells us that Avraham Avinu was sitting outside his tent looking for guests is because he was concerned following his Bris Milah. And there was a reason why Bris Milah was such a nisayon for Avraham, is because he was afraid that people would shun him, that people would stay away from him, because now he did this Bris Milah to himself, where he is standing up and saying, I am different from all of you, and I am making a physical sign of my body to represent that I am different from all of you. Why would anybody associate with him after that, after he has stood up and announced his difference to the world and distinguished himself clearly in public, right? Be'etzem hayom hazeh, Avraham got up and in broad daylight, against the advice of some of his fellows of Aner and Eshkol, against their advice, he went ahead and he did the Bris Milah in full view of everybody, so that they should all know that he was making a Bris Milah on himself. That's what Hashem told him to do. But now Avraham is concerned. Now Avraham is concerned because people used to come and he used to have guests and he used to be able to teach them about Hashem. And now, who's going to want to associate with him? So Avraham Avinu goes out and he's looking for guests because he's very concerned. But think about what Avraham is doing now. He now has, again, he's designated himself as different. He's designated himself that he has a relationship with Hashem that no other nations have. But where is he? He's still living Be'elonei Mamre. He's still with Aner, Eshkol, and Mamre, who are not Jewish people. They are not part of his bris, but they are his, but he associates with them, he lives with them. And he's looking for guests. Who are these guests going to be? Are they going to be Jewish people? No, of course not. There's no one else who's under Avraham Avinu's bris with Hashem that's not in his house. It's Avraham, it's Yishmael, it's the people in his house who had a bris milah. But nobody else. Who is he going to expect to come by his door on this day? Idolaters who don't have a bris milah, who know nothing about Hashem, who else could he expect? And yet, those are the people Avraham wants to help. Those are the people that Avraham is looking for. And when they come and pass by his door, these people who to him appear like Arabs, they appear to be these nomads whom he tells them to wash the dirt off their feet because he assumes they're idolaters. These are the people whom Avraham is so happy about, so happy to help them, so excited that they show up, that he throws himself into helping them. He involves his entire family. He tells them to hurry up and let's serve them a meal and let's help them and be hospitable to them and put them under the tree and give them shade and bring them food and drink. And Avraham goes to such lengths to take care of them. And that's even though they are not nimolim. They do not have a bris. They are not part of his relationship with Hashem. It's dafka these people that Avraham wants to help. And the lesson here is, says Rav Hirsch, that despite the fact that Avraham has a bris, and that Avraham is different, because Avraham is part of a covenant with Hashem, that does not diminish his involvement in society. It does not diminish how he regards other people in the world around them. And Rav Hirsch writes, and I quote from the commentary, he says, how maliciously have Judaism and its bearers, the heritage of Avraham and its heirs, been maligned? these circumcised ones arrogantly regard themselves as the only ones of their God. The sign of the covenant, which sets them apart from other nations, removes from their hearts all cosmopolitanism, all feeling of being united in brotherhood with the rest of mankind. They reduce the God of heaven and earth, the God of all human souls, to the God of their tribe, the God of their small country. So here Rav Hirsch is quoting the people of the world, these other the nations looking at the Jews and saying, how, when the Jews say they're the chosen people, that means they look down on everybody else. They have no interest in everybody else. And they say that other people are not important, and the Jewish people think they are the only ones. This story of Avram's Haknas Orchim, the only story we have of Avram hosting guests in his home in the Torah, this story specifically put here after his bris milah to show us what Hachnosas Orchim means to Avram. Hachnosas Orchim is not only for his own. Chesed is not only towards people like him. But Avram Avinu is reaching out to the world at large. He feels that he is a part of a bris with Hashem, but at the same time, he's also part of the world. And he recognizes all human beings as fellow men, and he wishes to help them. And to help them, to Avram Avinu, is a mitzvah. It's a mitzvah of Gemilas Chesed to help these people, these idolaters who come by his door. And that's how he feels, how he interacts with the world around him. And it's this story is here to counteract that impression of what it means to be the chosen people, of what it means to have a bris milah. It does not mean that we are the only ones who are important and everybody else is pushed to the side. No, it means that we have a special place in the world, in Hashem's world, to spread Hashem's teachings, to be role models of Hashem's spirit to the world around us, but to share that with everybody else and be a part of the world. Right? We are to be a part of the world while still being apart from the world. So we're chosen to spread Hashem's presence to the rest of the world and to be what Rav Hirsch calls a herald of the divine spirit. And this, so it's this story that captures Avram's legacy as a Baal Chesed, what it means to be a Baal Chesed in the world. It means to be a Baal Chesed to our own and also to be a part of the world around us. And that's a message that's given here. Because it refers, points out that specifically through the Bris Milah, Avram became Avraham. He became the Av Hamon Goyim, the father, a spiritual father for all the multitude of nations. He became an instrument of Hashem to uplift the world. And that he accomplished by sitting in front of his tent and waiting for guests to come, guests whom he could teach, guests whom he could share the message of Hashem with. And even though they would be idolaters, even though they would not be part of his covenant with Hashem, he still viewed himself as part of the world at large. And Rav Hirsch point says, he said that even Gentiles will readily admit that one character the Jews have is that they're willing to open up their hearts and their hands to the people around them in the world, and that they are interested in humane causes, even though they may not be directly related to the Jewish people. So Rav Hirsch makes this point as well in the... Well, before I get to the 19 letters I wanted to quote, it's we should see what Rav Hirsch says on the next pasuk as well. So then on the next pasuk, after Avram sees the guests, so the pasuk says in pasuk Gimel, "Vayomar," that Avram said, "Hashem, im no matzasi chen be'einecha, al nasa avar me'al avdecha. Hashem, if I find favor in your eyes, do not go away from your servant." So this word Hashem is a matter of dispute as to whether this word Hashem, which is here is spelled Aleph Dalid Nun Yud, is a question of whether it's Kodesh or Chol, whether it refers to Hashem. I say Hashem because of the opinion that it may be Kodesh, but it could be Chol, that it may not refer to Hashem. It may mean my masters. In Perek Yud Tes, when the Malachim come to Lot, Lot, it says, Vayomer hineno Adonai, please, my master, suru no al beis avdechem, turn to your servant's house. And there, Lot refers to the malachim as Adonai, my masters. So here, this word may also be referring to the Malachim themselves, where Avram is telling the Malachim, please don't pass by my house, come inside, let me take care of you, let me host you for a meal. Whereas if he's talking to Hashem, so then it refers back to the beginning, the first pasuk, which said Vayero ala Hashem, Hashem appeared to Avram. We don't say what Hashem said to Avraham, but then Avraham sees the Malachim. So then Avraham says to Hashem, Hashem, please wait, I need to take care of these Malachim. How could Avram do that? So from here, Chazal tell us in the Gemara that Chnosas Orchim is greater than Kabbalas Pnei Ashchina. Because Avraham was able to tell Hashem to wait, because he was going to do a mitzvah of Hashem, and then he would come back to Hashem afterwards. According to the opinion that the word is chol, so Avraham is talking to the Malachim, so then, Vayero Elav Hashem, Hashem appeared to him in the beginning of the parasha, where did Hashem go? So then, reverses, we would explain the opening pasuk of the parasha to be referring to when Hashem appeared to him after the Malachim leave. It's just an introductory pasuk saying that Hashem appeared to him at Elonei Mamre. How did that happen? Well, it all started when these guests showed up, and then the story continues from there. Right? So those are the two ways to read this pasuk. But Rav Hirsch points out that either way, whether Hashem appeared to Avraham right after he did Hachnasas Orchim, or whether Avraham interrupted Hashem's conversation with him to go perform the mitzvah of Hachnasas Orchim, either way, we learn something very interesting about Nevuah here, about Hashem's conversation with Avraham. Because Hashem's conversation with Avraham is really subsidiary at this point to the Hachnasas Orchim. Avraham first is taking care of his guests, he's interacting with these people, he is feeding them a whole meal, and then he talks to Hashem. So the lesson we learn from this about Nevuah is that prophecy does not result from hisbodidus, from abstract contemplation, from sitting alone and just contemplating Hashem. That's not how one develops a close connection to the divine. But how does one connect to Hashem? One connects to Hashem by living a life of joyful service of Hashem, of doing mitzvos that as Hashem commanded him. And this is what Chazal tell us. Chazal tell us, the Gemara is in Shabbos, Daf Lamed Amud Beis, Ein Shechina Shora, that the Shechina does not rest upon a person, meaning a Navi, but it could mean how a person develops a connection to Hashem as well. Lo mitoch atzlus, lo mitoch atzlus, not through sadness, not through laziness. Lo mitoch schok, lo mitoch kalus rosh, not through frivolity or levity. Lo mitoch sicha, lo mitoch dvarim betalim, not through chattering or schmoozing, and not through dvarim betalim, through nonsense. Ela mitoch simcha shel mitzvah. Through simcha shel mitzvah, the joy that comes as a result of performing a mitzvah, that is how the Shechina comes to a person. So it's not through sitting and contemplating that a person all of a sudden has this vision from Hashem, but it's from doing a mitzvah and from actively doing what Hashem wants us to do. That's how a person connects to Hashem. That's how a person feels closer to Hashem. And the doing a mitzvah turns a person into an instrument, a messenger of Hashem in the world, and that's how he develops a connection to the Shechina. So I want to quote from the 19 letters, where Rav Hirsch deals with this issue of the Jew and the Gentiles around him, and how we interact with them, because we do have this issue of as Jews, as B'nai Torah. So we are different. We have a different lifestyle. We have different mindsets. We are very different people. And it's a matter of how do we relate to them. We don't want them to think we're odd. We don't want them to think that, we don't want them to be repulsed by us in our strange way of life. But at the same time, we also don't want to become too close to them. So Rav Hirsch addresses this in the 15th letter of the 19 letters. And the edition I'm using is the edition with the commentary of Rabbi Elias. So I'm reading from page 205, which is really the very end of the 15th letter. And here Rav Hirsch addresses those concerns. And I'm going to read two paragraphs from the 19 letters. But what about our relations with Gentiles? We make ourselves so conspicuous, we are recognized at once as Jews. This is the question which Rav Hirsch is responding to. So he answers, but then who tells you to deny or conceal the fact that you are a Jew? Be a Jew, a true Jew. Strive for the ideal of the real Jew, the fulfillment of the Torah in justice and loving kindness. Seek to command respect because of your Jewishness, not in spite of it. Understand your own Jewishness and spread its true meaning among your non-Jewish brethren through your words and even more through your way of life. Then you will no longer have reason to complain that you cannot conceal your Jewishness. But you grumble that you will not be able to be on more intimate terms with them if you cannot at least eat and drink with them at their social gatherings. Again, I would say, practice righteousness and loving kindness as the Torah teaches you. Be fair in action, truthful in speech, bear love in your heart for your non-Jewish brethren, as the Torah teaches you. Feed their hungry, clothe their naked, comfort their suffering, heal their sick, counsel the misguided, assist them by word and deed. In short, display the entire noble breadth of your Judaism. Do you really think they will not respect and admire you, that you will not attain a degree of intimacy compatible with your own way of life? So here Rav Hirsch is addressing the issue of how do we get along with the Gentiles when we so clearly stand out among them? Right? This is Avraham's concern. Avraham's concern as a nimol that he would not be able to associate with the world around him. Avraham's concerns were really of a pure motivation than ours. Avraham's concern was most likely because he wanted to be able to spread the word of Hashem to people. Our motivation is really more about how do we get along in the world? How do we provide for ourselves in a non-Jewish world as Jews, without being shunned by the world around us? And so Rav Hirsch says that the answer is not to conceal our Jewishness, which was obviously the answer to the reform that he was dealing with here. But his answer was to be a Jew, and to, as he wrote, to command respect because of the Jewishness and not in spite of it. And to be a Jew doesn't mean to shun all the non-Jews around us. But Rav Hirsch says that instead of socializing with them and getting along with them in that sense, to rather be role models of what it means to be a Jew and to help those in need, and to model what it means to be a Jew to them. And despite the fact that we won't be able to socialize with them over food and drink, we will still attain the level of respect that we're looking for from the non-Jews, a level of respect. Well, they will understand that these people are Jews and they have different standards, they have a different lifestyle, but they respect that. And that's what that's what our goal should be. And that's what Rav Hirsch writes at the end. And he says that at that point, do you think that you will not attain a degree of intimacy compatible with your own way of life? It's a degree of intimacy where we can be partners in this world, so to say, that we walk in this world side by side and have that level of relationship, but while not coming at the expense of our own way of life and undermining our own ability to serve Hashem. And one of the parts of what Rav Hirsch says here that I think is often overlooked is the part where he says that understand your own Jewishness and spread its true meaning among your non-Jewish brethren. Because he writes through your words and even more through your way of life. Again, it's talking about modeling what it means to be a Jew through our actions rather than and that way commanding respect from them and teaching them what it means to be a Jew. But of course, the first part of the sentence, understand your own Jewishness, is equally important. It's important for us to understand what we're doing, why we're doing it, so that we can explain it to them in an appropriate way if asked. And that way we can really model what it means to be a Jew, to be an Eved Hashem, and through our actions. Perhaps not through socializing, becoming friendly with them, but through our actions, we will be able to walk side by side with them in the world and be able to participate as Jews in a non-Jewish world, as citizens of the world at large, and contribute, and still be able to preserve our way of life and maintain a comfortable distance, to be a part of the world while remaining apart from the world. And Rav Hirsch makes a similar point, but in a slightly different way, at the very end of the parasha, after the Akedah at the very end of Perek Chaf Beis, Pasuk Yud Tes. And this is after the Akedah, and after Avraham brings the ram as a karban, and after the Malach gives Avraham, or after Hashem gives Avraham his brachos. So then Pasuk says, Vayashav Avraham el Ne'arav, Vayakumu Vayelchu Yachdov el Be'er Shava. That Avraham returned to his young men who were accompanying him, and they got up, Vayelchu Yachdov el Be'er Shava, they went together to Be'er Shava. So Rav Hirsch notes here that the expression Vayelchu Yachdov appears here, and this is the third time it appears in the narrative of the Akedah. It appears twice with Avraham and Yitzchak, once after they leave these young men, after they leave the Ne'arim. It says, after Avraham tells them, Shivu lachem poem hachamor, va'aniv ha'na'ar, right, and we will continue. And then it says, Vayelchu Shnehem Yachdav, the two of them went together. Avraham and Yitzchak went together. And Rehearse says that there they went together because only Avraham and Yitzchak could go up to the mountain. The two of them went together to the exclusion of the young men who accompanied them. They had to remain behind. Only Avraham and Yitzchak were able to go up to Har HaMoriah and face the challenge of the Akedah. And then again, after Yitzchak asks his father and says, where is the sheep for the Ola? And Avraham says, Elokim yirelohaseh le'ola b'ni, and the Hashem will show us the sheep, in a way, hinting to Yitzchak, there is no sheep, but you are the sacrifice. And again it says, Vayelchu shnehem yachdav. Yitzchak, knowing what he faces now, continues to go together with Avraham Avinu. And they go in with the they go with this mindset that they are going to face this challenge and they are going to do what Hashem asks of them. And then comes the Akedah. And when they come back down, it's again Bayelchu Yachdav El Be'er Shava. That they go together, but this time the Yachdav includes the Ne'arim. It's not just Avraham and Yitzchak, but it's the Ne'arim as well. Even though they passed this test, they passed Nisayon, which is the highest Nisayon that Avraham had to pass. After it wasn't until the Akedah that Hashem said to Avraham Avinu, "Atoya dati ki yirei Elokim ata." Now I know that you fear Hashem. But this is the test where Avraham finally and Avraham Yitzchak rose to an unbelievable level. We know the Akedah had lasting impact on Yitzchak's life. He couldn't leave Eretz Yisrael. He was somewhat considered somewhat of a karban for the rest of his life because of the level that he reached as a result of his self-sacrifice at the Akedah. But nevertheless, when they come back to the bottom of the mountain, they are yachdav, they are again together. They feel themselves together with the Ne'arim, who couldn't even go on the mountain with them. They were not on that level. And Rav Hirsch says, this is astounding. This is astounding, he says, because if there was an Avraham and Yitzchak from another nation, this would not be so. Why? So let me read the Rav Hirsch in the commentary, verbatim. He writes, "This is most typical of the spirit that had its beginnings in Avraham and Yitzchak. After such an ascent to God's closeness, after such an elevation above all earthly concerns, an Avraham and a Yitzchak belonging to any other nation would have been so full of themselves and of the divine that they would no longer have taken any interest in ordinary earthly concerns and in ordinary human beings. In any other society, such closeness to God, even if only imagined, generally engenders such arrogance in those who experience it that they look down in disdain on all other men as mere mortals and avoid all contact with them. Not so the spirit that is to be perpetuated through the example of Avraham and Yitzchak. Just after performing the most exalted deed a person can perform, they return to the attendants they had left at the foot of Har HaMoriah and go Yachdav together with them. They do not consider themselves superior to the others in any respect. To the true son of Avraham, no man is better than any other by virtue of his vocation. And he sees no distinction between himself and a humble woodcutter or servant. The higher his own moral and spiritual level, the less likely is he to feel superior to others, and the less he is conscious of his own greatness." And I think there's really nothing to add to Rav Hirsch's words there. He really says it all. That this is a lesson we see from Avraham and Yitzchak. No matter how high they climbed, no matter how close they became to Hashem, they still felt themselves part of the world, part of the people around them. They didn't look down on people as, they're not as good as us, or they don't understand, they're not on the same level, they're not as close to Hashem, I can't associate with such people, it's beneath me. They were yachdav, they were together within the Aram. It's a tremendous lesson to us about achdus among our own, among Klal Yisrael. And it's also a lesson on how we relate to the Umos Ha'olam, how we relate to our non-Jewish neighbors, and how we relate to them. We should not look at people, right, so first, based on this example of Avraham Yitzchak, we should not look at people who may not be as close to Hashem as us, or may not be on the same level as us, to our own minds, as beneath us. Because I think the most powerful line of her says there is that the higher a person's moral and spiritual level, the less likely he is to feel superior to others. And if he does feel superior to others, then that says something about his level. It belies his feelings of being on a higher level, and something is not right. And Rav Hirsch concludes, he writes, Avram and Yitzchak returned from the summit of Har HaMoriah as though they had done nothing extraordinary. Vayashav Avraham el Ne'arav, Vayakumu Vayelchu Yachdav. It's a powerful message to us about what it means to be a part of the world, to be a part of the world at all times, and with all people. And it's a lesson for Achdus. One more thought I want to share from Rav Hirsch in this parsha about our relationship with the world around us is at the beginning of Perek Chaf. And the first pasuk of the Perek says, Vayisami Sham Avraham Artza HaNegev. Avraham traveled to the south, the southern part of Eretz Kna'an. Vayeshev ben Kadeshu ben Shur. He lived, he dwelled between Kadesh and Shur. Vayagar Begrar, but he sojourned in Grar. So Rav Hirsch says that there's two parts here, this pasuk. Is Vayeshev ben Kadesh ben Shur. He lived, his permanent dwelling was between Kadesh and Shur, which is Midbar Shur, it's a wilderness, there's nothing there. It's in the Negev. Vayagar Begrar, but he would sojourn, occasionally he would travel to Gerar, the capital of the Plishtim, where the king lived, where Avimelech was. So it's interesting that Avram travels, Rav Hirsch points out, that Avram's travels, initially, when we see the beginning of Parashas Lech Lecha, Avram avoided an urban setting. He avoided cities. He was in isolation. We read about how Avram was halokh v'nesoah ha-negba. The Negev, as we know, is deserted. It's a desert. It's a wilderness. There's nothing there. Avram was just a nomad, traveling from place to place. Take me shamahara. He went to the mountains. The mountains are further north, but again, in the mountains, there were no large city there, no real civilization there. He was on his own. And eventually, later on, Avram gets to Hebron. He goes to Elonei Mamre and starts associating with people. But here now, Avraham, after being in Hebron for many years, goes Bein Kodesh Bein Shur. He moves back to isolation, back into the wilderness, to as he was in the very beginning. But he is occasionally going to a large city, a large non-Jewish city of the Plishtim. So Rav Hirsch says that he thinks that the reason why Avram moved back to the wilderness is because of the imminent birth of Yitzchak. Because it was important for a son of Avraham to be brought up in isolation. He couldn't be brought up in Hebron and Elonei Mamre, to be among Aner Eshkol Mamre, be among the non-Jews. He couldn't live together with them. That wasn't for Yitzchak. The new child, Yitzchak, had to be educated far removed from any negative influences, where he could be taught to serve Hashem by his parents. At the same time, though, complete isolation would not help, and would in fact be damaging, because... let me read from Rav Hirsch from the commentary. Again, I'll quote, because it's worthwhile to see this in his own writing. On the other hand, complete isolation, which denies the student all contact with people who think differently and whose aims and way of life differ from his own, is a dangerous educational mistake. A young person who has never seen a way of life other than that of his parents, never had an opportunity to compare his parents' lifestyle with that of others, and never learn to appreciate the moral contrast between the two, will never learn to value, respect, and hold fast to the ways his parents have taught him. He will surely fall victim to outside influences at his first encounter with them, just as one who fears the fresh air and closets himself in his room can be sure of catching cold as soon as he goes outdoors. And this is, as we know, is one of the underpinnings of how Rav Hirsch felt about how a Jew should interact with the world, how we educate children. And that complete isolation to shelter children is not good, because he gives the analogy of catching cold when you go outside after being indoors for a long period of time. So it's important to expose children to other ideas, even ideas that are antithetical to Torah. So we can say, look at that. Now you understand what antithetical ideas are. Now you appreciate what we do. Now you appreciate the Torah that we're learning. Obviously, we want it to be in a controlled environment. We want it to be vayagar bigror. It's traveling there from time to time. It's sojourning there. It's not a permanent arrangement. And it's in a controlled environment where we can teach the child how to address concerns that he may have because about these antithetical ideas and how he approaches them. But at the same time, it's important to see the contrast between a Torah life and an anti-Torah life. And that gives a person a better appreciation for the Torah life that he has learned in his home growing up. And of course, it's with the caveats, like I said, of being in the right place, the right time, and the right setting. Rav Hirsch himself points out that Avram went to the land of the Plishtim because he writes that they were not quite as degenerate as the other nations of the Canaanim, and we know that because the Plishtim were not on the list of nations promised to Avram Avinu. The Amori, and the Perizi, and the Chivi, and so on, all those nations were clearly far gone and corrupted, as well as the Mitzrim, whom we read about in last week's Parsha. But the Plishtim were apparently not quite as bad, and that's why when Avram chose to have a certain culture to open Yitzchak up to, he probably chose that of the Plishtim because they were on a slightly lower level, or on a lower level of degeneracy than the other nations in the land at that time. And Rav Hirsch writes about this at length in an essay that's printed in the Collected Writings in the 7th volume, which is the volume that concerns Jewish education. And this is an essay that's entitled A Classic Principle of Jewish Education. And the classic principle referred to in the title is Chanoch Lena'ar Al Pi Darko. And I leave most of the essay for the listener to review at his own leisure at some point this week or later on. But I do want to quote to you a couple of sentences here from the tail end of the essay, or a few pages from the end. Where Hirsch talks about this idea of exposing children or students to different ideas as part of their Torah education as well. So Hirsch writes, and I'm reading from near the top of page 291 in the 7th volume of the Collected Writings. He writes, Jewish educators must not only teach their pupils the Torah, but must also point out to them all the antagonistic influences under which the Torah must be kept today. Only if one knows the essence of what is antagonistic to Torah can one resist and overcome these influences. That which looms as a fear-inspiring giant specter in the twilight zone of ignorance will shrink into a pygmy before the shining light of thought. So, and Rav Hirsch goes on and talks about how we have to teach children about ways of lifestyles that are antithetical to Torah. And we have to talk about why people go off the derech, why people are attracted to reform. And we have to, of course, undermine those arguments. But we have to at least bring up those arguments because they're going to ask those questions themselves. And it's important as part it's important to not just pass on traditions routinely, but we have to address the questions that the children are undoubtedly asking themselves. And if we don't address the questions, they will one day ask them and they will not find answers. And it's important to show them other views, to show them the falseness of those views, and teach them how to address those challenges that may come up in their own minds and from people around them, so that they appreciate the value of Torah and understand how one can, and it will strengthen them to follow a Torah lifestyle, even as they are a part of a world that may not necessarily be hospitable to a life of Torah and mitzvot. So again, another lesson from Rav Hirsch on how we can function as part of the world while remaining a part of the world, and how we can teach our children in a way that will help them to grow up as Ovdei Hashem and have questions and answer those questions and still remain steadfastly committed to a Torah way of life.